Good morning, and welcome to Speak With Power. I'm your host, Daniel Kirbine, here on KBBF FM 89.1. This is a weekly program for a limited time, about 12 installments, in which we explore just what is speaking with power. What is this thing that causes somebody to come from being a nobody to a somebody, or at least in their own mind? What is it that brings somebody from being the quiet person in a corner with lots of ideas that aren't getting expressed into somebody who has something to say and other people need to hear it and they get heard? What is that? That's what we explore here on Speak With Power. So today, we're going to look at that a little bit. The background music you're hearing, by the way, is Tina Malia. We're going to have some young women's voices on here for sure. In fact, the second half hour is going to be totally devoted to young women's voices, young women who have spoken at the UN, young women, a 13-year-old girl in 1979 spoke to the UN and just floored them. About the environment, by the way, 1979, then 40 years later almost, 33 years later, another young woman came before the climate conference in Durban of late last year in the fall, and just floored them there. Two very powerful speaking young women. And we will be followed by a live interview with Aaliyah Williams, who is a prize-winning contestant in the speech and debate forensics department at Annalee High School in Sebastopol, California, who has won, and we're going to replay her speech to the Veterans of Foreign Wars. And it's about a really deep exploration about service to country, about war, about what is all this that goes into this spirit of service to country. First, we're going to explore some of the people who are in world history famous for not just for the speeches they gave, because one of the speeches you'll hear, to me, is not all that dynamic. I'm going to play part of it. It's what led up to it. It's what it took to give that speech to the world. Of the listeners here, can anybody imagine that you were being called upon to give a speech to the world and you were going to lead the world against fascism? That it's you have been called, you are the one, and you're going to lead the world against fascism, against the forces of destruction, against the forces of the destruction of all freedoms. Well, that's what we're looking at here with the next two speakers. The first one is Winston Churchill. And by the way, these are speakers who had something really serious to overcome. Now, there may be some people in our listening audience who are saying to themselves, hey, you know, I have some language barriers to overcome. I have an accent. I have a lisp. I have a stutter. I have all these things to overcome. Here are people who had all of that to the point where, for instance, Winston Churchill, who was born in 1874 in England, but to hear him speak regularly before he was trained, before he got himself some training as a speaker, he was somebody who you wouldn't have even known that he was English because of the way he spoke. He had a lisp, a very serious one, and he had a very gravelly voice. He had what anyone in his life, and people actually did say, he had a speech impediment. So here's a man with a speech impediment who goes on to become the Prime Minister of England at a time when the island of England is being attacked, invaded, bombed by Nazi Germany, bombed by fascists who are saying, we are going to destroy you. We are going to take you over. We've already done it in France. We've already done it in Austria. We've already done it in Holland. We've already done it in France, and we're coming for you, England. And that was Hitler, Adolf Hitler, sending his Messerschmitts and his bombers over England on a daily basis, bombing London, bombing pretty much every city they had. So Winston Churchill had to motivate and rally the people of England to hope and toward that they actually would emerge with victory. So this is a CD of Winston Churchill's speech. This was in the late 1930s, early 1940s was when this was occurring. And so this is Winston Churchill. This is one of his famous speeches. It's, we will fight them on the beaches. We'll win, basically, but we're not going to stop. We will not surrender was the theme of the speech. So here we go with Winston Churchill, Prime Minister of England. And he talks a lot about empire, which is very interesting because England doesn't have much of an empire anymore. But at that time, that was one of the rallying cries, I think, for the English people was, hey, we're going to keep our empire together. We're great. We're strong. We can get into that in other ways later. But it was really essential that they win. And here's what he had to say about it.
Sir, I have myself full confidence that if all do their duty, if nothing is neglected, and if the best arrangements are made, as they are being made...
You can hear the lisp a little bit, but the English people didn't.
...to defend our island home, to ride out the storm of war, and to outlive the menace of tyranny, if necessary for years, if necessary alone. At any rate, that is what we are going to try to do. That is the resolve of His Majesty's government, every man of them. That is the will of Parliament and the nation, the British Empire and the French Republic, linked together in their cause and in their need, will defend to the death their native soil, aiding each other like good comrades to the utmost of their strength. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island, or a large part of it, were subjugated and starving, then our empire, beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old. The old fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be free, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us, therefore, brace ourselves to our duties, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
Yes. All right, that is Winston Churchill, Prime Minister of England, during the 1940s, under attack by the airplanes and bombs of Adolf Hitler, and of course... The forces of tyranny and the forces of fascism. So that was his inspirational speech. Now we're going to hear from the King of England. And it starts off with a trailer from a movie called The King's Speech. This is where the King of England has a rallying... It's really not much of a rallying speech, but he has to appear... as kind of a formality. There's a brand new exposition that was built in Scotland, and his purpose of his speech is to express the unitedness of the United Kingdom, Scotland, and Northern Ireland, and England, and how they're all working together, and they're coming out of a Great Depression. They're under fire by an enemy. It's quite a time. So he knows, just like Churchill knew, that he would have to overcome. Now, what the king had, King Edward, was a very vicious stutter. And in the movie, Prince Albert was called upon to lead the British Empire, which comprised almost a quarter. He was next in line to be king. Almost a quarter of the world in the 1930s. He was unsure whether he could be able to play his role as King George VI. He was about to enter into that. And it was primarily due to his awkward stammer, which prevented him from delivering the public speeches which were required of him in the changing world order. So he was about to become the king, King George VI. Would he be able to give the most important public broadcast which would justify England's war against Germany? Would his unconventional speech therapist, the failed Australian actor Lionel Logue, cure him of his disability before D-Day? So it won Oscars, it won accolades, it's called The King's Speech. Here's a trailer from it, and I do have one of the King's speeches that was recorded during that time, and we'll just play a tiny bit of it. This is not actually the one that's considered the great one. It just has his voice, but you can hear where he is, might even be about to stutter, but he conquers it every time. It's quite a training that he got. So this is the trailer, and you get to hear some scenes from the movie and just how well acted, how badly this thing was plaguing and vexing the future King George VI.
My husband is what is required to speak publicly.
I have to see Dick.
Perhaps he should change jobs.
He can't. And what if my husband were the Duke of York?
Forgive me, your...
Royal Highness.
Royal Highness.
My husband has seen everyone. No avail.
Enunciate.
He hasn't seen me. What was your earliest memory?
I'm not here to discuss personal matters.
Why are you here then?
Because I bloody well stammer!
Do you know any jokes?
Timing isn't my strong suit.
Your methods are unorthodox and controversial.
Up comes your royal highness.
It's actually quite good fun.
My brother is infatuated with a woman who's been married twice. Wallis Simpson.
Yes, there's a lot of drama in this film.
The nation believes that when I speak for them, but I can't speak. Why should I waste my time listening? Because I have a voice!
Yes, you do.
Good time.
Your first wartime speech.
However this turns out, I don't know how to thank you for what you've done.
Yes, that's Colin Firth, Jeffrey Rush, Helena Bonham Carter in The King's Speech, directed by Tom Hooper. It's probably available on DVD, no doubt. Next little piece is...
This is the ultimate issue which confronts us. For the sake of all that we ourselves hold dear, and of the world's order and peace, it is unthinkable that we should refuse to meet the challenge. It is to this high purpose that I now call my people at home and my peoples across the seas who will make our cause their own. I ask them to stand calm and firm and united in this time of trial. The task will be hard. There may be dark days ahead, and war can no longer be confined to the battlefield. But we can only do the right as we see the right, and reverently commit our cause to God. If one and all we keep resolutely faithful to it, ready for whatever service or sacrifice it may demand, and then with God's help, we shall prevail. May he bless and keep us all.
And so what we find from a film such as this King's Speech, and what we find from the example of Winston Churchill, is that it is possible, no matter what's in the way, that the key is knowing that you have something to say and that other people need to hear it. Someone who feels they don't have anything to say, no matter how eloquent they are, is not going to deliver whatever that speech is. They actually don't have a speech in them. The person who has a speech inside is the person who has something that other people need to hear, and they know it. They have something that needs to be said. It's going to change the world. They have something that needs to be said that's going to change people's minds, that's going to change the way people see things. It's going to be changing the way they think of things. It's going to change the way they do things. Now, here's another, I'm going to give you another example. This is another Englishman. So it looks like the first half hour is all about the English. It's all about the British, the people who actually come from England. But this is somebody who, it's a little different, who actually came from England and never spoke in his performances because he was a famous silent movie actor. His name was Charlie Chaplin, and some people may even, out in the audience, may know who I'm talking about. Charlie Chaplin, the beloved funny hobo of silent movies from the 1920s, before sound was even in the movies, who would just, it was all pantomime then, and he was just the most wonderful pantomime actor to watch. He just was tremendous that way. So this is when Charlie Chaplin actually had his first, one of his first movies with sound, and he became a satirist. And this was a movie in which he was satirizing Adolf Hitler, yes. This was early 1930s when Adolf Hitler had just become the Chancellor of Germany. And Charlie Chaplin could see where fascism was going. He could see where fascism was taking over in Italy. He could see where the government was in league with the corporations to enslave the people. And that was really what the definition of fascism is. In fact, that definition of fascism, corporations or corporate business in league with the government for the ends of really taking all the money and taking away freedom and making people enslaved, was actually the dictator of Italy, Mussolini. That is how he defined fascism. That was his own. He actually coined the word fascism, and that was his definition of it. Chaplin saw this, and so this is a speech that Chaplin gives in one of his films. I actually don't remember the name of the film, but I do have the speech here for you. And he's quite, once he got to where he could speak, so this is all about, this whole half hour is all about people who were in the darkness of not being able to speak and give their message when they finally were enabled to do it. And this is Charlie Chaplin, the famous mime actor who now is speaking and speaking with power.
I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent, and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and little children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes. Men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate. Only the unloved hate. The unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery. Fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man. Not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power. The power to create machines. The power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful. To make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world. A decent world. That will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future, and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power. But they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason. A world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite! I'm sorry.
Yes, a lot of references to men in these speeches from the 1930s and 1940s. That's how it was. A little break from that here with Tina Malia. This is The Silent Awakening. The next half hour is going to be dominated by women, young women, who have messages to give. And until that point, we'll be breaking for station identification and a couple of public service announcements. But before that, a couple of excerpts from a publication by Toastmasters. Toastmasters International, which is an organization that teaches people the techniques of speech and the techniques of improved speech. And this is a little booklet that you get when people become members of Toastmasters. They get a set of booklets, and one of them is titled Your Speaking Voice, Tips for Adding Strength and Authority to Your Voice. The production of voice quality, the human voice as an instrument, and a little bit about how we use our voices. Do you whisper or boom? Some people speak too loudly. At the other extreme are those who can barely be heard. Voice loudness or volume should be appropriate in strength and intensity and should be varied in order to add emphasis and dramatic impact to your speeches. Inaudibility is different from speaking softly with vocal support. A whisper is air without sound. Air must vibrate against your vocal cords to produce audible sound. When you speak about something, are you monotonous or melodious? Does your voice convey life, color, and melody? Or do your sentences come out flat, wooden, and without variety? Do people find your vocal range pleasant? Good speakers vary their speech to express emotion and conviction. The highness or lowness in the sound of your voice is known as pitch. If your voice is squeaky, guttural, shrill, or flat, then what you will do is work on your pitch. The desired speaking pitch sounds low, clear, full, and varied. We are the roots of the banyan tree. We are love offered on the wings that stretches across eternity. We are a chord, like a symphony on the silent awakening. And the rate at which you speak is closely associated with your personality. Consequently, your rate is difficult to change because it relates how you think and behave, how you live your life. Yet, avoid speaking either too slow or too fast, because either one can distort your articulation, limit your changes of pitch, and alter your vocal quality. A slow speaker may not realize how listeners struggle to pay attention, and people think at a much faster rate than the flow of speech. Overly slow speech encourages listeners to daydream. Talking too fast creates similar problems. When information is spewed forth at a rapid rate, listeners become frustrated and tune out. A fast speaker also may shorten sounds and fail to vary intensity, volume, and pitch. The most effective speaking rate is between 120 and 160 words per minute. So speak rapidly enough to avoid being a drone, and slowly enough to be understandable, and others around you who are coaching you can assist you with that. So we will be exploring here a little bit more of what that sounds like when a young woman finds her vocal power and finds what that is that needs to be said and that other people need to hear. So we will be hearing from two people, from two young women, one of whom spoke at the United Nations in 1979 and just wowed them there, and another young woman who was just last fall at the conference on climate change in Durban and just blew everybody away at that conference.
Hello, I'm Severin Suzuki speaking for ECHO, the Environmental Children's Organization. We're a group of 12 and 13-year-olds trying to make a difference. Vanessa Setti, Morgan Geisler, Michelle Quigg, and me. We've raised all the money to come here ourselves, to come 5,000 miles to tell you adults you must change your ways. Coming up here today, I have no hidden agenda. I am fighting for my future. Losing my future is not like losing an election or a few points on the stock market. I am here to speak for all generations to come. I am here to speak on behalf of the starving children around the world whose cries go unheard. I am here to speak for the countless animals dying across this planet, because they have nowhere left to go. I am afraid to go out in the sun now because of the holes in our ozone. I am afraid to breathe the air because I don't know what chemicals are in it. I used to go fishing in Vancouver, my home, with my dad, until just a few years ago we found the fish full of cancers. And now we hear of animals and plants going extinct every day, vanishing forever. In my life, I have dreamt of seeing the great herds of wild animals, jungles and rainforests full of birds and butterflies. But now I wonder if they will even exist for my children to see. Did you have to worry of these things when you were my age? All this is happening before our eyes, and yet we act as if we have all the time we want and all the solutions. I'm only a child, and I don't have all the solutions. But I want you to realize, neither do you. You don't know how to fix the holes in our ozone layer. You don't know how to bring the salmon back up in a dead stream. You don't know how to bring back an animal now extinct. And you can't bring back the forest that once grew where there is now a desert. If you don't know how to fix it, please stop breaking it. Here, you may be delegates of your government, business people, organizers, reporters, or politicians, but really, your mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers, aunts and uncles, and all of you or someone's child. I'm only a child, yet I know we are all part of a family, 5 billion strong. In fact, 30 million species strong. And borders and governments will never change that. I'm only a child, yet I know we are all in this together and should act as one single world towards one single goal. In my anger, I am not blind, and in my fear, I am not afraid of telling the world how I feel. In my country, you make so much waste. We buy and throw away, buy and throw away, and yet northern countries will not share with the needy. Even when we have more than enough, we are afraid to share. We are afraid to let go of some of our wealth. In Canada, we live the privileged life with plenty of food, water, and shelter. We have watches, bicycles, computers, and television sets. The list could go on for 2 days. 2 days ago here in Brazil, we were shocked when we spent time with some children living on the streets. This is what one child told us. I wish I was rich. And if I were, I would give all the street children food, clothes, medicines, shelter, and love and affection. If a child on the streets who has nothing is willing to share, why are we who have everything still so greedy? I can't stop thinking that these are children my own age, that it makes a tremendous difference where you are born, that I could be one of those children living in the favelas of Rio. I could be a child starving in Somalia, or a victim of war in the Middle East, or a beggar in India. I am only a child, yet I know if all the money spent on war was spent on finding environmental answers, ending poverty, and finding treaties, what a wonderful place this earth would be. At school, even in kindergarten, you teach us how to behave in the world. You teach us to not to fight with others, to work things out, to respect others, to clean up our mess, not to hurt other creatures, to share, not be greedy. Then why do you go out and do the things you tell us not to do? Do not forget why you are attending these conferences, who you're doing this for. We are your own children. You are deciding what kind of a world we are growing up in. Parents should be able to comfort their children by saying, everything's going to be all right. It's not the end of the world. And we're doing the best we can. But I don't think you can say that to us anymore.
Yes, and that was Severin Suzuki speaking for United Children's Organizations. It was November 30th, 1979. I did some math, she'd be about 46, 45 or 46 years old now. She was 13 years old then. We're going to wait on the Durban conference speech because we're going to play back something that actually was a speech given by a student at Annalee High School, which is located only a few miles from the studios of KBBF, that was given by Aaliyah Williams. She's a member of the forensics team, which is the speech and debate team of Annalee High School. And if you want to catch a little bit of how exciting speech and debate and forensics is, here's a trailer for a 1989 film called Listen to Me, which is all about a speech and debate team. It's pretty cute. A really worthwhile movie to see, kind of romantic in a way, but it definitely embodied what was going on with the speech and debate. We'll do that, this little clip first, and then we're going to hear Aaliyah's speech.
Debate, as practiced here, is rougher than football.
They live in a world where words mean everything.
Meaner than ice hockey.
Where argument is the weapon of choice.
And because women can play at it.
You're tremendous. You're supposed to be brilliant.
Just as down and dirty as the men.
Haven't you ever heard of the women's movement?
Yeah, but I wish I had.
It's probably the scariest, most fascinating sport on the face of the planet.
There isn't anyone they can't talk to.
I don't want to be Tucker's debate partner.
We usually end up debating each other instead of our opponents. You know, I don't think I want to be your partner either.
Except each other.
Shut up, okay? I'm pretty liking this.
What would you say if I told you that you could be debating in front of the Supreme Court this spring?
Sometimes I think I'm not going.
And yes, that is some of the potential that's there for the speech and debate and forensics candidates and contestants in the speech and debate clubs in our many high schools. They do these marvelous and amazing things, speak in front of legislatures, speak in front of Supreme Courts, go head-to-head with each other in debates. Sometimes they'll even debate against something they actually believe just to prove that they can debate it. It's an amazing training that they get, and it's called forensics. It's called speech and debate. I have a little bit to reveal here, which is that my firstborn daughter was on the speech and debate team out of El Molino High School, which is in Forestville, California, under the coaching of Earlene Reichert, who's now retired from the school. But it was quite an experience, and it really grooms the students to become maybe lawyers, but definitely to become leaders, definitely to become inspiring people. And it's something where they never get funded the way football does. You know, that's why I wanted to put this on the air on the couple of days or the day after the Super Bowl, because we put millions and billions of dollars into the sports, but it doesn't happen so much with the speech and debate teams. So I'm going to put this, going to bring this off of the laptop. We're going to hear a little bit of Aaliyah Williams, and then we're going to have her on the phone.
Sophocles, one of the greatest playwrights of all time, and, as few know, a general in the Greek military once said, "The only crime is pride." A curious concept from a man who led armies to victories. So why is this? Pride. Noun. A high, unreasonable, or inordinate opinion of one's own dignity, importance, merit, or superiority. This sounds like no soldier I've ever known. A soldier's sense of duty is what drives him to serve his country. A soldier's courage is what makes her go overseas. A soldier's humility is what makes them a leader, a hero. As Lieutenant Colonel Joseph Doty eloquently argues, humility, or the quality of genuine modesty and unpretentiousness, is often disregarded when describing traits of good leaders, because it seems to suggest a lack of toughness and resolve essential in an effective leader. However, the humble leader lacks arrogance, not aggressiveness. The will to serve others eclipses any drive to promote self. So is there pride in serving in the military? Perhaps. But the pride is put there by civilians, proud of our troops. The soldiers themselves are taught values as numerous as the lives they touch and save. One life is saved by strength, even under unimaginable circumstances. Another by bravery in the face of death. One by compassion for their own and their enemies. And by respect for everything they have the opportunity to effect. I know a man who embodies all of these traits. My cousin is a pilot in the United States Air Force. And when I was a little girl, he was my idol. Every little girl wants to do what their big cousin tells them to. So before he deployed to Iraq, I asked him what I could do for our country, our soldiers. He told me the best thing I could do was to thank them. Not long after, I was flying through the Seattle-Tacoma airport when a man in uniform walks by. I run up to this man, just 6 years old, pigtails bouncing and a lisp due to my lack of front teeth. I was more a sight to laugh at than anything. I run under the soldier's boot, dart in front of him, nearly trip the poor man, look up and say, "Thank you. Thank you for keeping us safe." This man, just returning home from one of the most horrific experiences anyone can go through, begins to cry at the words of a 6-year-old girl. Was he proud? No. Grateful. Humble. These are our soldiers. Soldiers do not boast their wartime accomplishments. They do not put themselves above or beyond the rest of their platoon. Soldiers are forced to work with those around them, and in doing so, they achieve accomplishments that would be unimaginable if they were prideful. The medals and honors we give out are joyous reminders of their actions for those who make it home. The monuments and cemeteries we build are solemn memorials to those who have fallen. The stories written are our beaming pride for our soldiers, the ones who fight every day for our freedom, and the veterans we have to thank for this land. The stories are written reminders that even though the causes we fight for are noble, at the end of the day, there are always families that will be forever waiting for their sons, brothers, husbands, and fathers to return home. That the horror of war is something larger than any one of us, and larger than any pride. There's no pride in a soldier's tearful eyes as he returns home. Just a simple love for his country, freedom, family, and values. No pride in an amputation a soldier must receive because of a road mine. Just an acceptance of what is, and his incredible strength to move on from it. No pride when a soldier falls to his knees in a cemetery, staring down at the name engraved in stone and tears of his childhood friend. They will never see another Friday night, or another one of his children's birthdays. They will never again hug his wife or understand exactly how proud of him we really are. Because although our soldiers push their pride away, we should embrace it for them. Alas, these brave men and women accomplish more, and from a civilian perspective, have more to be proud of in one tour than many people have in their whole lives. Soldiers display strength beyond their pride. Soldiers demonstrate self-sacrifice before their pride. And no matter how much pride we have in them, our soldiers exemplify humility.
So that is an excerpt. It's almost the complete speech by Aaliyah Williams, and we have her on the telephone here. Do you hear me right now, Aaliyah?
Yes, I do. Hello.
Hi. We want to make sure we have some time here for your interview, so I have paused that speech so that we can talk to you about it. What is it that brought about the speech? Did you write that yourself, and where did you deliver that speech, and what was the result?
That speech was actually part of a contest put on by the Veterans of Foreign Wars, and I did write it myself. The topic this year was, is there pride in serving in the military?
Yes.
I delivered it here at my high school, and then I delivered it, and then I actually put it onto a CD recording, and it went on to compete for me, and I wound up taking it all the way to the state level of the competition.
That's great. That's very successful.
And thank you.
Yes. So you are training under your coach and teacher in forensics is Lynette Williamson at Amelie High School.
Yes, she's absolutely amazing.
I've spoken to her, and yes, she's just very devoted to, and that's what I've experienced with the speech and debate coaches, is that they're very devoted to the work that they're doing. And so what is it in your life that brought you to the point where this is something that you want to do? Is it something where, I mean, is it that you're argumentative by nature, or is it something where you feel as though you've got some things to say and you'd really like for people to be able to hear them said?
Well, that depends on whether you ask me or my parents about the argumentative.
Very good.
I was brought to speech and debate actually because my high school went around to the middle schools in the area and attempted to recruit. And I joined, and then I just fell in love with it. And I, you know, the more that I've done with it, I'm a junior now, and so this is my third year on the team. And the more that I do, the more that I find that I can affect people, and that it really just gives, especially students who are so often overlooked, a voice and able to change things and to be able to actually, you know, speak out about things that they're passionate about.
That's really terrific. And what would you say to people as words of encouragement for someone who might be thinking, maybe as someone who's young or somebody who is a parent out there listening, that would be some words of encouragement to someone who is of student age, someone who's of a young age, who is sitting there thinking, well, maybe what they're thinking is I'm afraid of being in front of a group of people standing there by myself having to say something. Or they might be just saying, what do I have to say and what's so important that I'd have to say that someone would actually listen to it? And there's a number of reasons why people might be blocked in that, especially young people. Do you have any words to say to them?
All that I ask is that they give it a chance, because I was definitely afraid of public speaking. I could not stand to get up in front of an audience, and I thought that it might be something that I even had the smallest inkling of fascination with, and I gave it a shot, and now 3 years later, it's my whole life, and it's providing career opportunities, and colleges love it, and it's really just been a huge benefit, and there's no downside. So, you know, even if all you can do is stand up in front of people for 30 seconds, I mean, hey, that's 30 seconds longer than you could before.
That's right. That's a very good point. And it's about practice then.
Absolutely. Practice, practice, practice. You know, you can be born with all the talent in the world, and if you don't cultivate it, it never turns into anything. And, you know, I didn't have anything when I first came to speech and debate, and then it's really shown me how to have my own voice and how to be able to get out there in the world.
Well, would you be of the opinion that forensics programs and speech and debate training programs in schools would be something that it would be worthwhile to have them funded to the level, for instance, that you see football being funded and people are getting injured for life sometimes. I mean, I know it's not the only thing that happens. They do learn certain types of teamwork, and it's physical play, and it's physical discipline. But, I mean, here's something that's an extreme mental discipline, and it's something that prepares the student for what in the real – actually, football doesn't prepare you for the real world, in my opinion. It's just my opinion about it. There are people who differ with me on this. I know. We could have a debate about that. Debate resolved, right? That football prepares people for the real world. And I believe that it doesn't. I believe that things like forensics, like speech and debate, actually do that. And prepare for certainly the career world. So I'm doing all the talking here. What's your opinion about some of this?
Well, I find that anything that you put your heart into, anything that you do is going to have some serious benefits in the outside world. You know, granted, in football, they may be things like learning how to shout numbers or learning how to, communicate with your team. The real benefit, especially from speech and debate, is not the debating experience, not learning how to be argumentative or how to structure a debate case or how to make a good policy. But the real benefit is when you realize that you can walk out into the world and you have communication skills and you know how to interact, especially with people older than you, and you know how to not be afraid and you know how to work both autonomously and together as a team. And it's really the biggest benefit that I've had in my life. Not only that, but it helps you get over fears, you know. I never go into a job interview nervous anymore because I know how to talk to people, and that's one of the best benefits you can possibly get.
Well, that is really a lifelong one too, isn't it?
Absolutely. It will extend far past high school for me and everyone else on my team.
I've been in a number of situations where people have said, well, somebody needs to go and talk. Just for one example, I'm involved with the Sierra Club, and someone needs to go to the Board of Supervisors and say something about the watershed and protecting it for the salmon. And it's very typical because people being in their ordinary situations, nobody comes forward. But there's this person who has had a little bit of speech training who will say, okay, you know, I'll do it. I've never done this before, but it can't be that different. Even though it might even be scary, there's all these big, important, powerful people. But if you've had a little bit of training and experience with it, it's a lot easier to get over with.
Yeah. I find that if you ever find yourself sitting in that situation, you know, someone needs to go say something about this, why don't you just go do it? I mean, no one can say what you're thinking better than you can, and no one can get across the point that you need to get across better than you can. And in order to do that, a lot of us do need a little bit of help, and speech and debate training certainly helps with that.
Well, one of the things I've noticed in our conversation here today already is that, especially with the back and forth about the issue around football, and yeah, football players, please, listen to what Aaliyah said. She's being diplomatic, and that it looks as though you've had some training in your approach to debate where you have learned to be diplomatic and to be able to at least concede that there is some validity to both sides, depending on the viewpoint. Is that part of the training you get?
Well, what happens is that in debate, we're given a topic, and we're told our side on that. So we never get to choose what we want to say about it. We have to be able to see the arguments on both sides of everything.
That's a very interesting thing.
Yeah,
that
we run drills where you start delivering a speech, and then you have to stop and immediately refute what you just said. We literally argue with ourselves.
That is really, man, talk about a learning and a teaching experience.
It's quite the experience, for sure.
And at the whole time, you're competing with students from other schools at certain different levels.
Yeah, absolutely. And just like any, you know, sport, quote-unquote, although people wouldn't call us a sport, just like anything else, you know, we have our lead, and we have a novice division and a junior varsity division and a varsity division, and, you know, we are a mental sport.
Yes. And so I have one more question to ask you about your speech, the one that we have played an excerpt of, and it's about the military. You gave the speech to the Veterans of Foreign Wars?
Yes.
And the question was, it was an answer to a question, which is, can you tell me what the question was?
Is there pride in serving in the military?
Right. And your approach was a little bit,
different.
Challenged the mind, your approach, evidently, because that's what I'm hearing in it. So can you describe that?
Well, It just seemed like a topic where, especially given the audience, absolutely everyone would have the same approach. You know, no one's going to say no to a bunch of veterans that there isn't pride in serving in the military.
Of course.
And so I took a look at it again, and I realized that, you know, pride, according to some religions, is one of the seven deadly sins.
Yeah.
Pride, as I quoted in my speech, the dictionary definition of pride is not something to be revered.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that we want for ourselves. It's something that we want to give to other people. And so I tried to promote that the idea that we shouldn't be prideful in ourselves, but rather have pride in others and be humble and have humility in our own lives.
That's really great. And you wound that into the whole thing of being of service, and that's really what it was all about for the veterans. I could see how they could appreciate that kind of message.
Yeah, I wound up taking one of the top five spots in the state out of nearly 1,000 students, so I guess they did appreciate it.
And would you then, Aaliyah Williams, recommend to parents who might be listening that they seek out and see what their school district has to offer in the way of forensics and speech and debate teams and coaching and training?
Well, again, with the diplomacy, I have to say, don't push your student into anything. If they don't love it, pushing them to do it isn't going to do them any good.
No.
But absolutely, look into it and tell your students that this is a really good life skill and a really good way to promote building skills that you'll need later on, especially for jobs. And it looks amazing on colleges.
Yes.
Or on college applications. It looks absolutely fantastic. So I think that it's definitely something that parents and students should be looking into, especially if their student is someone inclined to enjoy things like this.
Right. The motivation really has to come from within the student.
It really does. And I've seen people that have been pushed into it by their parents, and it doesn't turn out too well.
I could imagine not. And what would you say about the quality and the level of the training and coaching that you've been getting at Annalee High School?
My coach is absolutely phenomenal. Like you said earlier, her name is Lynette Williamson. And if you come to Annalee, any parents or students that are out there listening, if you come to Annalee and you ask any student how it is to have Miss Williamson as a teacher, as a coach, we will all say that she is absolutely phenomenal. She just puts so much time and dedication into us and into coaching us and into cultivating us. And not only that, but we, you know, as much as debate and speaking is an individual thing, we really are a team. And we have our varsity members help out our novice members, and we have everyone, you know, work together in order to get that much better. And we've been doing really well at it, I think.
Oh, it sounds like the results really show that. Okay, Aaliyah Williams from Annalee High School, Sebastopol, California, forensics team, speech and debate, winner of a speech contest with Veterans of Foreign Wars at the state level. Thank you for joining us here on Speak
With Power. Thank you very
much. All righty, have a good day.
You too.
On the wings that stretches across eternity, we record life's
I'd like to give the floor to Ms. Anjali Appadurai with College of the Atlantic, who will speak on behalf of youth non-governmental organizations. Ms. Appadurai, you have the floor.
I speak for more than half the world's population. We are the silent majority. You've given us a seat in this hall, but our interests are not on the table. What does it take to get a stake in this game? Lobbyists? Corporate influence? Money? You've been negotiating all my life. In that time, you've failed to meet pledges, you've missed targets, and you've broken promises. But you've heard this all before. We're in Africa, home to communities on the front line of climate change. The world's poorest countries need funding for adaptation now. The Horn of Africa and those nearby in Kwamashu needed it yesterday. But as 2012 dawns, our Green Climate Fund remains empty. The International Energy Agency tells us we have 5 years until the window to avoid irreversible climate change closes. The science tells us that we have 5 years maximum. You're saying, give us 10. The most stark betrayal of your generation's responsibility to ours is that you call this ambition. Where is the courage in these rooms? Now is not the time for incremental action. In the long run, these will be seen as the defining moments of an era in which narrow self-interest prevailed over science reason and common compassion. There is real ambition in this room, but it's been dismissed as radical, deemed not politically possible. Stand with Africa. Long-term thinking is not radical. What's radical is to completely alter the planet's climate, to betray the future of my generation, and to condemn millions to death by climate change. What's radical is to write off the fact that change is within our reach. 2011 was the year in which the silent majority found their voice, the year when the bottom shook the top. 2011 was the year when the radical became reality. Common but differentiated and historical responsibility are not up for debate. Respect the foundational principles of this convention. Respect the integral values of humanity. Respect the future of your descendants. Mandela said, "It always seems impossible until it's done." So, distinguished delegates and governments around the world, governments of the developed world, deep cuts now. Get it done.
Who was speaking on behalf of half of the world's population, I think she said at the beginning. And on a purely personal note, I wonder why we let not speak half of the world's population first in this conference, but only last.